Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, A. Quinlivan illustrates the strained relationship between the Irish Free State and Dublin Corporation, which was central to his recent study. He examines how, after the Civil War, the Corporation continued to irritate the central government and how the dissolution of Dublin Corporation came to be. A. Quinlivan is an author and senior lecturer. This episode was recorded at the Mansion House on the 27th of September, 2023.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Brendan Teeling. I work in the Dublin City Libraries. And a great pleasure to welcome you to the Oak Room here in the Mansion House for our talk as part of the Dublin Festival of History, which is a project of Dublin City Libraries, where I work, and our colleagues in the Dublin City Council Culture Company. And just like to thank you all for coming out tonight on such a bad evening, but it's a worthy cause. Dublin, the sanctity of Dublin Corporation, Dublin City Council, who pay me, so you know it's very dear to my heart. I'd just like to thank Karen and Siri for coming along, and our colleague from Four Course Press, so the copies of his book available at a special price. So A. Quinlivan is works at the Centre for Local and Regional Governance at University College Cork. And back in 2021, A wrote the book that he's discussing this evening, Vindicating Dublin. And it was published by Dublin Corporation, Dublin City Council, through Four Courts Press. And we were delighted to do that. It's one of a series of books that we've been publishing over the past while, documenting some of the big issues around the corporation, some of them positive in terms of what the corporation achieved, and some of them a bit more challenging, I suppose, for the corporation. And among those are a series of books on housing in the city. So Ruth McManus and Joe Brady, the same year as A's book was published, we published Building Healthy Homes, which tells the story of how the council's first social housing projects were undertaken. And I recommend that book to you highly. And we should have a talk by Ruth McManus on the podcast later, because we're recording an event that she's doing tonight. But keep an eye out for those. And in fact, they're publishing another volume for the later period, 1940s. And we're looking forward to that next year. A tells me he's working on a book on a man I describe as Cork's Alfie Byrne, but he might describe as Alfie Byrne's Cork's Sean Crowe. And I'm sure he might say a bit about that. But really, we're here to talk about Vindicating Dublin. And it's a great pleasure to have A here. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Brendan. It really is a tremendous honour to be here with you to talk about the controversial dissolution of Dublin Corporation in 1924 and my book on that subject, Vindicating Dublin. I realise that's a fairly standard thing to say, but in my case, I truly mean it for three essential reasons. As Brendan has mentioned, the book was published in 2021 through Dublin City Council and Dublin City Library and Archive. And I received great support there from the likes of the retired city archivist, Dr. Mary Clark, and from Anne-Marie McInerney, as well as from Brendan himself and Joey Kavanagh. Four Courts Press and Anthony Tierney have been very good as well in distributing and promoting the book. And of course, as mentioned, you can pick up a copy this evening through Martin. Unfortunately, due to COVID restrictions, we never had the opportunity to formally launch Vindicating Dublin. I did have the chance to present copies of the book to the second last Lord Mayor of Dublin, Councillor Alison Gilliland, and to Jim Gavin, amongst others. There have also been some favourable reviews, thankfully, in the Business Post, History Ireland, and the Dublin Historical Record, to name a few sources for you. So the book has been in the public domain and doing well. Tonight is special for me, however, as it is my first real opportunity to talk about it before a captive audience. So I intend to take full advantage of that. If the storm reappears, we could be here for the night. You never know. Secondly, to say I've always admired the Dublin Festival of History from afar, but have never been part of it. So it's a thrill to finally participate in 2023. And thirdly, the venue. Much of Vindicating Dublin played out in the Oak Room of the Mansion House, including corporation meetings and the famous public inquiry of 1924. So I'm grateful to Donald Fallon and the festival organisers for selecting this location for tonight's talk. Interestingly, the first meeting of the commissioners who replaced Dublin Corporation took place in the City Hall on the 29th of May 1924, because City Hall had not been used by the corporation since British forces occupied it on the 22nd of December 1920 and removed the municipal flagstaff. And even after the City Hall was handed back by the British and was in the possession of the provisional government, it was not used for local authority meetings until after the dissolution of the corporation. So more of that anon, but for now, it is suffice to say that I am honoured to be here, and those are not empty words. I will start, however, with a confession. Attaching labels, I think, is not especially useful, but I am not a historian. However, in my work as a political scientist, where I specialise in local government, I often find myself drifting towards the past, and in particular the period around the foundation of the state, which has an enduring fascination for so many of us. In that sense, I agree with the American historian Henry Glassy, who said, "History is not the past, but a map of the past, drawn from a particular point of view to be useful to the modern traveller." Accordingly, though I shall be talking about the past predominantly, I will try to link it at the end to the present day. Another American historian, David McCullough, not the RTE David McCullough, even though his biographies of Eamon de Valera are terrific, but the US David McCullough wrote, "History is who we are and why we are the way we are." And a lot of issues that emanated in the 1920s tell us much about local government in Ireland in 2023. Okay, to commence properly, if I can get this working. My wish, and indeed my hope, is that you will enjoy what I have to say over the next 45 minutes or so. As Mark Twain said, good friends, good books, and a sleepy conscience, that is the ideal life. If my talk, or indeed the book itself, do not meet your expectations, I take full responsibility and apologise in advance. My University College Cork lecturing habits die hard, so I am using PowerPoint, apologies for that, and will follow the structure on the screen, moving from context setting through to the inquiry of 1924, the subsequent dissolution of the corporation, before drawing a few conclusions at the end. The context is straightforward. In the second decade of the 20th century, Dublin Corporation was a highly political institution. It was a persistent thorn in the side of the British administration and functioned almost as a national parliament in the absence of a sitting legislature. It refused honours to visiting members of the royal family, passed endless resolutions of a nationalist hue, and offered a springboard to aspiring anti-British politicians. In the words of Basil Chubb, the corporation was a thriving centre of nationalism. It was also an unpopular institution and was savaged on a daily basis by the Irish Times, which delighted in repeating the phrase, "Dublin has the worst municipal government in the world." In a January 1913 editorial, the same newspaper, the Irish Times, noted, "Municipal business has no natural association with politics. So long as our corporation continues to be dominated by politics, it will continue to neglect and mismanage the ratepayers' interests." It also complained about what it described as the bigotry of the nationalist majority in the corporation. A variety of interest groups and organisations also had an openly anti-corporation agenda, led by the Dublin Citizens Association and the Chamber of Commerce. The decision by Alderman Tom Kelly to read aloud the famed Castle document during a corporation meeting was a significant moment in the build-up to the rising of 1916. The Castle document outlined a plan from the British Undersecretary, Sir Matthew Nathan, to intern all known nationalists prior to Easter week and to suppress all known nationalists, as well as ordering the disarming of the Irish Volunteers. The authenticity of the Castle document is debated to this day, but it did raise tensions in Dublin. During the 1916 rebellion itself, City Hall became a garrison for the Irish Citizen Army. Councillor Richard O'Carroll was shot dead by Captain John Bone Colthurst. Held at gunpoint with his arms raised in the air, the Irish-born officer Bone Colthurst asked Councillor O'Carroll if he was a Sinn Féiner and received a reply, "From the backbone out." At this point, Bone Colthurst shot O'Carroll with his revolver and he died from his injuries 9 days later in Portobello Military Hospital. O'Carroll's widow Annie gave birth to their seventh child 2 weeks afterwards. Of course, then we have the Dublin Corporation employee, Eamon Cant, who was one of those who signed the 1916 Proclamation of the Irish Republic and was subsequently executed. Many of the councillors of Dublin Corporation were arrested in the aftermath of the rising, including Patrick T. Daly, Lawrence O'Neill, Tom Kelly, Sean T. O'Kelly, William Partridge and William T. Cosgrave. The structural damage in 1916 caused to the City Hall and to the centre of the city created an enormous financial burden for the corporation, described as a catastrophe by Lord Mayor Councillor James Gallagher. The minutes of corporation meetings after the Easter Rising show that there was a growing and increasing bitterness by the elected members towards the British. The corporation was outspoken in calling for the release of those who had been interned without trial and an amnesty for those who had been sentenced to prison. Given that the Easter Rising was largely a Dublin-based affair, it would have been impossible for the corporation to be apolitical during 1916. Inevitably, national politics were increasingly to the fore in the years which followed. In the early months of 1917, some of the corporation's elected members remained in prison and a new Lord Mayor, Councillor Lawrence O'Neill, emerged as a prominent figure locally and nationally. He hosted political meetings here in the Mansion House and was invited to be a member of the Irish Convention, which was formed to present proposals to the British government for the future governing of Ireland within the Empire. The conscription crisis and the German plot hardened political opinion and anti-British sentiment, and the vibrant and populist Sinn Féin party took full advantage to claim a spectacular success in the general election of December 1918. This election heralded a major political realignment, and in giving effect to its pre-election promise, Sinn Féin members boycotted the Westminster Parliament and established its own assembly. In Dublin, it was now impossible to separate local and national politics. The historic first meeting of the Dáil was held in the Lord Mayor's Mansion House, and some leading members of the corporation were simultaneously members of the Dáil. The War of Independence then visited more debt and destruction on Dublin. For the second time in 6 years, O'Connell Street was reduced to rubble, and in December 1920, British troops took over City Hall. A couple of weeks earlier, a meeting of the corporation was interrupted by British troops who arrested six councillors. By 1920, Dublin Corporation was also effectively bankrupt. A breakdown in the relationship with the British Local Government Board meant reduced funding and many parts of the city lay in ruins with no prospect of reconstruction. When the Dáil ratified the treaty on the 7th of January 1922, it unfortunately did not signify a period of peace as the Civil War unfolded. Dublin Corporation remained largely neutral during the conflict, but it incurred the wrath of the Free State government by consistently raising concerns about the treatment of prisoners arrested during the Civil War. Requests for a delegation of councillors accompanied by the corporation's chief medical officer, Dr. Matthew Russell, to be permitted to visit prisoners in Dublin prisons were firmly and frequently rejected by General Richard Mulcahy on behalf of the government. This prompted Councillor Hannah Sheehy Skeffington to table a motion, unanimously approved, criticising the government. The motion ended with the following words: "We remind the Free State authorities that in refusing this right to visit prisoners, they are acting in an arbitrary manner and are depriving the representatives of the citizens of a right accorded to them even during the Black and Tan regime. The elected members in City Hall also attempted to broker a ceasefire during the Civil War, but their efforts were described as ill-considered by the government. Even after the Civil War ended, Dublin Corporation continued to irritate the government and William T. Cosgrave in particular. What I have attempted to demonstrate over the last few minutes is that Dublin Corporation was a deeply political institution and it liked to involve itself in national affairs. From 1916 through to 1923, it was an irritant to the British government and thereafter to the Irish Free State government. For its part, Dublin Corporation merely transferred its resentment from the British government to the Irish government. To the president of the DÁIL, William T. Cosgrave, so long a proud member of the corporation, the hostility of the municipal council was difficult to accept with equanimity. Something had to change, and it duly did. The mood of Dublin Corporation was pessimistic in the early months of 1923, and not just because of the continuing civil war. Another factor is what Dermot Ferriter has referred to as the utter contempt that had quickly developed at central government level for local democracy. Antrim man Ernest Blyde had been appointed as Minister for Local Government and Public Health in 1922 by William T. Cosgrave, and he wasted little time in stamping his authority. Officials of the Department of Local Government and Public Health were sent to audit and inspect many local councils, and the difficulties of local authorities were viewed from the centre with exasperation. The main official in the department was the secretary, Edward McCarran, known as E.P. McCarran. He was a controversial appointment because he was greatly distrusted by many local authorities, given that he was a former local government board member under the British regime. The attitude of Blyde, McCarran and other senior officials in the Department of Local Government and Public Health was both paternalistic and austere. They were less committed to local democracy than to notions of rectitude and efficiency. Blyde had successfully steered the Local Elections Postponement Act 1922 through the DÁIL in December, in the midst of the Civil War, the first of many times central government would defer local elections over the coming decades. The minister was also working on a significant piece of legislation, the Local Government Temporary Provisions Act of 1923. This legislation gave power to the minister to dissolve local authorities and replace them with a centrally appointed commissioner. Ultimately, despite criticisms, the Local Government Temporary Provisions Act was passed on the 28th of March 1923. The essence of the 1923 legislation was that the minister could dissolve a local authority having first ordered an inquiry into its performance. The reinstatement of the council following a new election would be decided by the minister with no time frame indicated. May 1923, just at the end of the Civil War, saw the first local authority dissolved under the provisions of the 1923 Act. And to no one's surprise, the victim was Kerry County Council, which had passed into Republican control. Other local authorities soon followed, And what is interesting is that the public acquiesced to this assault on their democratic rights, probably because the dissolutions occurred at a time of civil strife and there was little respect for local government. Dermot Ferriter comments, there was no evidence of public protest as a reaction to this flexing of central political muscle. Dublin Corporation was in the firing line. It was not a Republican local authority and, as mentioned, had strived to remain neutral during the Civil War. Nonetheless, it had antagonised the government, whose view was that sovereignty and self-government was to be vested in central government, accountable to an Irish Parliament in Dublin, not dispersed or extended to local areas. Therefore, it came as little surprise when the town clerk of the corporation, John J. Murphy, received a letter from E.P. McCarran on the 20th of February 1924, stating that the minister had decided to hold a public inquiry into the performance of Dublin Corporation under the terms of the 1923 Act. The traditional enemies of the corporation rejoiced in the news. The editorial in the Evening Herald bore the title Hope for Dublin Ratepayers and proclaimed as follows: the long-suffering, overburdened ratepayers of Dublin have read this morning with a feeling of relief and satisfaction that the Minister for Local Government has decided to hold an inquiry into the administration of the corporation. Practically every department of municipal administration in Dublin has been mismanaged. The facts are notorious. Jobbery and corruption are rampant at the City Hall. An enormous sum is paid annually for the cleansing of the streets, and yet Dublin, in that sense, is the dirtiest city in Europe. The members of the municipal corporation at the present stage of its deterioration are for the most part men of straw. They are not fitted in any sense to hold authority or to administer any municipal department. We hope that they have now arrived at the end of their tether and that the government will kick them out. The editorial also referred to the councillors as being corrupt and unscrupulous brutes. Of course, kicking them out was always the likely outcome. No inquiry ever called under the 1923 Act culminated in a local authority not being kicked out. At least a comprehensive inquiry took place in Dublin over 14 days. The inquiry into Mayo County Council lasted 20 minutes. But it was Mayo, I suppose. So, turning to the inquiry. The inquiry into Dublin Corporation forms the essence and the centrepiece of the book, and I'll spare you a lot of the details this evening. Proceedings began in the packed Oak Room of the Mansion House on Tuesday, the 11th of March, 1924. Minister Seamus Burke had appointed 29-year-old Nicholas O'Dwyer, Chief Engineering Inspector in the Department of Local Government and Public Health, to conduct the inquiry. Dublin Corporation had assembled an impressive legal team, led by two senior barristers, Patrick Lynch and James Lardner, supported by a local solicitor, P. White, and instructed by Ignatius Rice, the corporation's law agent. The opposition legal team was led by Norman Keogh, representing the Dublin Citizens Association, and W.J. Larkin speaking for the Dublin Tenants Association. I contend that the inquiry was a shambles. Professor Eunan O'Halpin describes it as perfunctory, and it got off to a very confused start. When E.P. McCarran had written to the town clerk in February, the letter referred to serious complaints regarding maladministration by the corporation. Not unreasonably, based on the principle of being innocent until proven guilty, the members of Dublin Corporation sought details of the specific charges which were being brought to bear against them. It turned out that there were none. Embarrassingly, when the inquiry started in earnest on the 19th of March, Norman Keogh, representing the Citizens Association, was unprepared, and he did not seem to grasp that the onus was on him to make a case against the corporation. Keogh's efforts over the 14 days of the proceedings were lamentable, and he was not helped by the ill-disciplined W.J. Larkin, who quit in the middle of the inquiry. The legal representatives for the corporation, Patrick Lynch and James Lardner, were cogent, professional and well-prepared. They comfortably outmaneuvered their opponents and had every reason to be satisfied with their performance as they dismantled many of the criticisms made against the corporation. The most impressive witness against the corporation was John Eason, speaking on behalf of his family business and the Dublin Chamber of Commerce. Eason criticised the lack of business capacity among the elected members of the corporation and argued that the burden of taxation was against the development of industry. He stressed that something needed to be done with regard to wages and other costs, such as pensions. He alleged that the corporation had failed in its duty as an employer, and he cited a number of issues in relation to terms of employment, wages and holidays. Eason felt that conditions and terms in City Hall should be the same as those in outside industries, and he pointedly commented, "The Dublin Chamber would like to know something of the position of the boys in the corporation who, it is felt, are being paid in an extravagant fashion." For his part, Chairman Nicholas O'Dwyer dutifully went through the motions of running a comprehensive inquiry, but the outcome had already been decided by the government. The anticipated news that Dublin Corporation was to be dissolved broke on the 20th of May, but the details surrounding Nicholas O'Dwyer's report and his recommendations remain a mystery to this day. In spite of numerous calls in the Dáil, it appears that the inspector's report was never officially published. Instead, a select group of journalists in Dublin were given sight of a 66-page document, and they gleefully reported on criticisms made by O'Dwyer in relation to excessive wages, the housing problem and high wages. Overall, however, O'Dwyer referred to the fact that administration in Dublin Corporation had been maintained to a very high standard, and it seems that he made no specific recommendation in relation to the dissolution. Predictably, the Evening Herald celebrated and ran a front-page headline of Dublin Corporation abolished, which, as we know, is not correct. It wasn't abolished. It was just being temporarily dissolved. The Irish Times also welcomed the decision and lamented that the corporation had been inefficient and extravagant. The Irish Times editorial stated that the rates were preposterously high, the streets were in a condition of chronic filth, and that the thoroughfares were a disgrace to a Lancashire mining village. The Belfast Telegraph described the dissolution of Dublin Corporation as a humiliation for the city, but a deserved one. Even the Roscommon Herald had a go, commenting, "Dublin's corporation has something in common with Dublin Stout. The longer it was kept bottled up, the more gas it produced." This is where we hit a not insignificant snag. In 2017, I wrote a similar book about the dissolution of Cork Corporation. I had access to a file in the National Archives where I was able to read and copy a verbatim account of the inquiry in Cork and a report of the chairman, who was also Nicholas O'Dwyer. One of the reasons I undertook the Dublin book is that I knew that there was a file in the catalogue of the National Archives in box 167, which is ingrained in my head, entitled Dissolution of Dublin Corporation. This was to be my treasure trove. Having specified the file and booked an appointment, I made my way cheerfully to the National Archives, only to be told, "Sorry, we are having difficulties locating the file. It may have been miscatalogued." The search for the file about the dissolution of Dublin Corporation ran for 2 years, but alas, it never showed up. Equally, there is no copy of Nicholas O'Dwyer's report or official documentation relating to the dissolution of the corporation in the Custom House, headquarters of what is now called the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. After my initial disappointment and thoughts of abandoning the book, I tried to make a virtue of the missing file and present it as a mystery, if not a conspiracy. So I cannot tell you what is precisely contained in Nicholas O'Dwyer's report, or if he indeed recommended the dissolution of Dublin Corporation. But either way, the outcome was inevitable. Professor Mary E. Daly states that the decision to dissolve the council was not clear-cut, and that it gave credence to the belief that the Cosgrave government was determined to reduce the autonomy of local authorities. She further argues that the corporation's record would not have justified its suspension in the era of the British Local Government Board. As I have stressed, Dublin Corporation was a difficult council, with the dominance of Sinn Féin councillors elected in 1920. Predictably, they subsequently split into pro-treaty and anti-treaty sides, and the Irish Times regularly questioned if the council adequately reflected and represented the citizens of Dublin. The pity, therefore, is that the government did not afford the citizens the opportunity to express their feelings. The decision by the government to postpone the 1923 local elections deprived the people of Dublin the opportunity to pass judgment on the performance of the corporation and its members through the ballot box. Judging by the large attendance in the public galleries each day of the inquiry, it can be asserted that the people would have gladly availed of the opportunity to elect a new council, which perhaps would have driven much needed administrative reforms. But in the absence of local elections, the same divided Dublin Corporation lumbered along under the continual morality of Lawrence O'Neill. Many of the councillors had been there for a sustained period of time, even before the Easter Rising of 1916. Quite a few of them had been imprisoned in the aftermath of the Rising and/or during the War of Independence. They were deeply political, and a long way removed from the technocratic and depoliticised local government system envisaged by William T. Cosgrave and E.P. McCarran. Understandably, the members of the corporation were appalled by the outcome. In August 1924, 11 of the now former councillors came together and published a 31-page booklet entitled A Vindication of the Municipal Council of the City of Dublin, and hence the title of my book. The driving force behind the document was Sean T. O'Kelly, who would be a future President of Ireland, and there were 10 other signatories. Noticeably, the Lord Mayor Lawrence O'Neill was not one of them. The government and the media were severely criticised, and Nicholas O'Dwyer was not spared either. O'Kelly and his colleagues wrote, "No report from the government official who held the inquiry was issued to enlighten the citizens as to the result of the investigation. Like Pontius Pilate, he found no cause, washed his hands and dried them with his report." On the evidence presented at the 1924 inquiry, Dublin Corporation did not deserve to be dissolved, but this is what happened. With Seamus Murphy, Patrick J. Hernan and Dr. William C. Dwyer starting their term as commissioners in late May. Their first meeting as the city's commissioners took place on the 29th of May 1924 in the Council Chamber of City Hall. The venue was significant, as I mentioned at the outset. It had not been used by the corporation as a meeting place since British forces occupied it on the 22nd of December 1920. Since then, the corporation had held its meetings in the Mansion House. Even after the City Hall was handed back by the British, it had been in the possession of the Provisional Government and was not used for local authority meetings. The Irish Times painted an evocative picture of the first meeting back in City Hall, saying, "Stripped of its upholstered seats and of the large oil paintings of former Lord Mayors which adorned the walls, the council chamber presented a strangely unfamiliar appearance. Even the Lord Mayor's oaken chair had disappeared, and the three commissioners and a few officials seated at a table carried on the business of a corporation of 80 members. There was no room for speech making in the commissioner's programme, and the sitting occupied 25 minutes only. Councillor Lawrence O'Neill struggled to accept the outcome of the inquiry. He claimed that he remained Lord Mayor of Dublin, as the citizens had not unelected him. However, the government made it clear that from the day the corporation was formally dissolved, he was no longer the Lord Mayor and could not live in the Mansion House. There can be no disputing that the three commissioners who replaced the council performed well in fulfilling their roles. They were diligent and thorough and provided much needed stability and calm after a decade of turmoil. The commissioners offered political impartiality and administrative professionalism, qualities which were highly valued by the government. In dealing with the dissolved local authorities, the Department of Local Government and Public Health found the commissioners to be more respectful of the law and probably more amenable to central direction than the councils they had replaced. Another important consideration for the government was that the commissioners were popular with the electorate and with the newspapers. Far from engendering hostility in the local electorate, the commissioners became the objects of local praise for their efficiency and frugality. An advantage of the commissionership years in Dublin was that it gave the government the breathing space to formulate proposals for the reform of local government. Chief amongst these was the introduction of the management system, whereby power would be shared between an appointed city manager and the elected council. The Local Government Dublin Act of 1930 allowed for the reinstatement of a new group of elected councillors working in partnership with the capital's first city manager, Gerald Sherlock. The Dublin legislation was keenly debated in the Dáil, with strong contributions from Cork deputies who were also members of the corporation on Lee side. Cork Corporation itself had been dissolved in 1924, returning in 1929 with Philip Monaghan as Ireland's first city manager. Deputy Dick Anthony expressed very strong views during the Dáil debates, referring to the Mussolini-like tactics of the city manager in Cork. He said Monaghan was vindictive and that the system of city management in Cork was objectionable, obnoxious and provocative. Cork Lord Mayor Sean French delivered a calmer contribution, expressing the hope that Dublin would appoint a city manager and not a city master. TJ Murphy, TD, a Labour Party deputy representing West Cork, pointedly expressed his opinion that local government in Cork was a distant memory. The situation in Cork was not helped by the fact that Philip Monaghan had served as commissioner from 1924 to 1929 in place of the elected members, so they despised him. In Dublin's case, Gerald Sherlock was a comforting appointment for the elected members, seen as a safe pair of hands and very well known, given that he had succeeded John J. Murphy as town clerk in August 1927. The environment had changed dramatically since 1924. A reorganisation and boundary extension had taken place, which meant that the Dublin city area had more than doubled, with the inclusion of places like Rathmines and Pembroke. The corporation itself was streamlined, with a significant reduction in elected members from 80 down to 35. This number included 5 seats which were filled by representatives of the Dublin business community without an election. The smooth transition in 1930 from the reign of the commissioners to the new managerial system was also facilitated by the election of a familiar figure as Lord Mayor, Alfie Byrne. Byrne was a very popular figure in Dublin, although the former commissioners would have frowned upon some of his extravagance. The burning question remains, why was Dublin Corporation dissolved? No specific charges were laid against the council. The prosecution case was poorly argued by Norman Keogh and W.J. Larkin. There was no proof of corruption, and as far as we can tell in the continuing absence of the official report, Nicholas O'Dwyer did not make a specific recommendation for dissolution. This book asserts that there were two motivations behind the dissolution decision. First, there was a jostling for political power within Dublin, as it was not only the home of the ancient corporation, but also the seat of national power, as the new government in the aftermath of the Civil War sought to assert control. Cosgrave and his central government cabinet colleagues were agitated by the corporation, which continued to engage itself in issues such as the treatment of prisoners. Better than anybody else, Cosgrave knew how the councils had been used previously to subvert British rule. He did not want them now to subvert Irish rule in the same manner. Essentially, the decision to dissolve Dublin Corporation was one undoubtedly driven by politics. Secondly, the government wanted to proceed with the reorganisation of governance structures in Dublin. Attempting to do so while an awkward, politically driven corporation with 80 members was in place would have been very difficult. Direct rule provided a unique opportunity for the restructuring of local government without short-term local political considerations dominating the debate. The government took the calculated decision to push the local elected members to the sideline while it proceeded with reorganisation, safe in the knowledge that the three commissioners were reliable, professional, politically neutral and critically popular with the citizens. The dissolution of Dublin Corporation was a means to an end, the introduction of a management system which remains in place to this day. The problem, though, is that in the 1920s, centralisation became embedded as the dominant philosophy, to the extent that today Ireland has the least autonomous model of local government in Europe, as highlighted by the recent damning Council of Europe report. In the politically sensitive post-Civil War years, the determination to divorce local government from national issues could be regarded as appropriate, but also idealistic, if not naive. The irony is that Cosgrave and his colleagues in central government were well versed in how local councils across the country had successfully undermined British rule during the War of Independence. They now felt that local autonomy had to be curtailed so that local authorities could not defy the Free State government in the same manner that they had defied the British. It is worth noting that the power of dissolution, introduced 100 years ago in 1923 as an experiment, it was called the Temporary Provisions Act, now is called the power of suspension, and it remains on the statute books. In fact, Dublin Corporation was also dissolved in 1969 until 1973 and was on the brink in 2003 under the mayoralty of Councillor Dermot Lacey. In November 2023, if Dublin City Council is struggling to pass its budget, it will once again be threatened with the axe. The respected local government scholar Dr. Mark Callanan poses a very valid question. Is it appropriate that one elected branch of government can effectively overturn the results of a local election and suspend another elected branch? This is a legacy of the Civil War period in Ireland and the introduction of the power of dissolution. Of course, the management system itself is also a legacy of this period, in that it grew out of the spate of dissolutions in the mid-1920s. Professor Eunan O'Halpin asserts that we have been well served by the management system. He notes, city and county managers were not conceived of primarily as agents of central government. Rather, they were seen as skilled technicians applying the antiseptic standards of scientific administration to matters previously dealt with in the unsavoury gutter of local politics. However, that system perhaps will also soon be shaken up. The people of Limerick passed a plebiscite in 2019 in favour of creating a directly elected mayor and will have an election for the post next year. The Dublin Citizens Assembly has recommended the position be established in the capital with major powers devolved to the mayor. If you have a directly elected mayor with a 5-year term of office and significant executive powers, where does this leave the city manager stroke chief executive officer? The draft Limerick legislation proposes that the role of the CEO be downgraded to director general. Of course, it has to be noted that legislation was passed in 2001, 22 long years ago, for the establishment of directly elected mayors across the country, but we are still waiting. So perhaps the current CEOs are secure in their positions for a while yet. I hope you enjoyed this talk with a focus on the 1920s, the dissolution of Dublin corporations, and the origins of the management system. I have tried to bring it full circle with some current references near the end. Returning to our earlier quotation from Henry Glassy, history is indeed a map of the past which is useful to the modern traveller. But we do not have to keep travelling the same road towards ever-increasing centralisation. We need to learn from our history and not be dictated by it. In the immortal words of Jimmy Dean, I cannot change the direction of the wind, but I can adjust my sails to always reach my destination. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.